It is my pleasure to introduce to you Thomas Brecker, President and Chief Counsel for the Thomas More Society, a legal defense organization that defends the sanctity of life, religious liberty, and family values. Tom Brecker has been litigating cases in federal and state courts for the last 4.5 decades. In 1986, Tom volunteered to assist defendants in the now infamous Now versus Scheidler cases. The Now case was so vast and complex that it crowded Tom out of his business law practice. When his law partners told him to quit the case or quit the firm, he resigned his law partnership and co-founded the Thomas More Society with Joe and Ann Scheidler. His topic, legal defense of pro-life efforts.
Thank you, Gordon. Thanks to Molly, Mike, all the folks at Cleveland Right to Life. We're very flattered to have been asked to join you. And I've got to tell you that, in the almost 20 years now, we've had the Thomas More Society operating as a not-for-profit public interest law firm based in Chicago, but with a nationwide law practice. We've been asked increasingly to help people set up and administer other pro-life not-for-profit entities. And we use that's not my kind of law. I'm a courtroom battler, but Sally Wagenmacher, who's on the board of the Christian Legal Society, has worked with us for at least the last decade, if not more, in helping folks, and I'm very glad we were asked to help Cleveland Right to Life reorganize. Sally helped in that regard, but now that I'm here and I see what a marvelous event this is, I think we're the ones that could use a little reorganizing by Cleveland Right to Life, and that goes for all the pro-lifers in Chicago and Illinois. Here's Dan Miller from Pro-Life Wisconsin. Maybe he's a Packer fan, but I think he would see that truth, too. But in any event, listen, Molly and Marilyn Christofi have given me a lot of topics. I don't think we can really cover them all, so I'm going to hit highlights and hope we have a short question period, but I'll be here for dinner, and please feel free to come up and with any questions. And especially if you your group is unincorporated, you want to organize, strike roots, get a tax exemption, help build pro-life infrastructure, please call on us. I'll be happy to have Sally contact you. We underwrite that. We raise the funds to cover efforts to expand pro-life infrastructure all over the country. I think one of the first outfits was Youngstown Right to Life, where they needed a tax exemption to raise money, and they did raise money enough to buy the old abortion clinic that was in Youngstown. It had been the scene of many court battles and so forth, and now it's a pro-life shrine. At least it was after they bought it. So everywhere we can do it. Sally's law firm has been expanding. We've had to expand, obviously. This is a growth industry, and isn't that a good thing? I mean, we finally, I don't know that we're in our infancy anymore, but I'd say we're in our adolescence as a movement. We're getting strength and staying power, and whatever the politics are at the moment, I think the long-term prospects are great. The Thomas More Society was born, we say, in a crucible of courtroom conflict. It was a crisis. Gordon touched on that. He asked me, and I told him a little bit. I was a business lawyer in Chicago, respectable lawyer, not involved in, quote, racketeering. Like, you know, what do you do? I'm from Chicago. I'm a racketeering lawyer. But I had an antitrust case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, so somebody asked me to lunch to meet this fellow who had been sued in Wilmington, Delaware, under the antitrust laws. And I thought, boy, this should be a real big deal. Well, it was Joseph Scheidler. And for those of you who don't know, Joe was a great leader of the pro-life movement. He's in his 80s now. He'd written a book back in 1985, Closed, 99 Ways to Stop Abortion. and for his leadership and his activism. He was picked by the National Organization for Women and the abortion industry, represented by two or three abortion providers around the country who sued as a class action for, quote, all women whose access to abortion facilities was interfered with or would be interfered with. Very questionable class definition, but that's the way things go in abortion cases, and all abortion providers in the U.S. And the theory was so simplistic, it really was hard to defeat. It was, if he's going to close down the industry, certainly that's a restraint of trade. Well, that's a perversion, to put it mildly, of the antitrust laws. And I was amazed, as I've become amazed and amazed over the years, by the ways to which and the extent to which the law is twisted in abortion cases. When young people ask me, how do I get into abortion law? I say, don't right away. Learn the craft in other cases. And then when you get into abortion cases, you'll understand that this is not the norm, you know, and you'll know how to deal with the aberrations that we encounter repeatedly, because it's a different kind of law. It's a cultural and spiritual battle, and it goes on in the courtroom just as it does on the streets outside the abortion providers. We've been representing 40 Days for Life around the country, and we fight the same battles over and over again, and the police finally are beginning to realize, you know, it's our constitutional right to be there in the public space and to advocate and to pray and to do so robustly. That's the essence of our American democratic tradition and the spirit and the meaning of the First Amendment. We're indeed as ardent and constant in our advocacy as the ACLU is, because, in fact, we're the ones who are advocating for change, for reform, for the good things, and they're on the other side trying to suppress the speech, the expression, the prayer of our activists. So I have two points by way of preface, and I can't be too much in the way of preface here. The time is going to evaporate, but first is that we need more Thomas More societies. We are not afraid of competition. We want more competitors, if that's what you want to call it. We want. We work with lawyers in St. Louis. We work with lawyers in Milwaukee. We work with lawyers in Los Angeles and San Francisco. But we want those, each of those cities, every town, hamlet, metropolis in America, to have a non-profit public interest vehicle that attracts lawyers who are willing and able to do this kind of work and do so aggressively and not, quote, as a favor, unquote, and to get out of court as soon as you can, but to press this cultural battle, because as I hope you realized from the talks earlier today, if you don't know from your own experience, we are in a cultural warfare that is going to last for quite a while, I think. It's going to outlast me, but just like an earlier speaker said, my good friend from Denton, Texas, you know, the young people will be here when we win that battle, but it won't be right away. But we've got to arm up and mobilize so we have the shock troops to do it. We're anxious. That's why we have Sally. We want to start up as many infrastructures as possible, and especially moving into the legal field, so lawyers don't risk their livelihood when they take on these cases. Well, that's what happened to me. AUL, Americans United for Life, used to be in Chicago. Now they moved to D.C. And they were young folks, very bright and everything, and they had done a lot of amicus briefs and appellate courts. But suddenly there was this big case that was shifted from Wilmington to Chicago. And the judge denied our motions to dismiss, you know, first surprise of many to come. Whoever thought you could have an antitrust case based on ideological political competition. But this was a time when nonprofits were coming under legal scrutiny for their impact on competitive markets. So we were a bit against the zeitgeist, even in that antitrust field. And anyway, the depositions were going to be taken, and the young guys at AOL had never defended depositions. So they asked me, the old man, at what was I, 43 or something, you know, to would I please get out and file, and not just be safely on the sidelines, but get into the front rank, and they would do all the work, and I would simply be the front fellow. Well, it turned out it went on for 11 years. We went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'd beaten them after four arduous years. Everything was dismissed. They had added RICO, racketeering charges, two or three years into it. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, those great civil rights advocates, were the lead lawyers for the plaintiffs. They dropped out. They didn't want to do RICO against a protest group. Good for them, but they should never have brought the stupid case in the first place. In any event, Patricia Ireland took over for NOW, and they added racketeering, complained the Reagan administration wouldn't take action, so they would do it. We got all those things thrown out in 1991 after the judge put us through all kinds of maneuvers we didn't have to do. He was going to dismiss the charges, but it took him 8 months to hatch this opinion, which we then got in the mail. But we appealed to the other side appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Everything was affirmed. No dissents. Case should have been over. They went up to the Supreme Court of the United States. The appeal certiorari was granted on RICO. And guess what? They reversed the RICO dismissal, and that was, I didn't argue that, but it would have been, how could it be worse than nine to nothing? It might have been if I'd done it. Bob Blakey, the Notre Dame law professor who wrote RICO, argued the case. And the Supreme Court said RICO could apply to non-economic protest. Whoever heard of a moneyless racket? Well, that's the law. Why? Because government agencies could be used as racketeering enterprises by corrupt politicians. So, again, we were up against the zeitgeist. It had nothing to do with abortion, I don't think, but we lost rather dramatically. We went back. There followed a few years of what I call the pilgrimage through the Valley of the Shadow of Death. It was not very... We had a new lawyer, a Clinton appointee, African-American, former NAACP fellow, and he did not like us. And our motions for summary judgment were denied. So what did that mean? We had a huge trial coming up, and we were scared. We were beleaguered. We were hard-pressed. My partners were just at wit's end. Scheider could not pay fees on a fee-for-service basis. Who could have paid fees for 11 years of coast-to-coast depositions? And it's just it can't be done. So my partner said, look, you either got to quit the case or quit the firm, I'm sorry. And 2 months later, I was gone. How could I quit the case? Impossible. They were in the middle of this lifetime spiritual, cultural battle. We had no other helpers. So that's why we need more nonprofit vehicles, because that's the only way we can sustain the huge efforts needed to counter this juggernaut we're up against, because there's a lot of money in abortion. Let me tell you, I'm astonished continuously. We've learned in the Dalyden case the amount of money that comes from the sale of body parts, not to mention the cash flow from providing these abortions on a routinized basis. One clinic in California, umpteen million cash per year, I'm sure much of it unreported. So, yes, the empire is coming back at us, and as many times as we find a chink in their armor, they come back in spades. We beat them in the Scheidler case. We're going to beat them again and again and again, but we need the wherewithal and the will to do it. And Thomas More Society is growing. But, you know, we're Chicago lawyers, and we need, when we go to California, we need California lawyers. If we're in Cleveland, I'm not going to get up there and argue in front of a Cleveland judge. I don't know this territory. Law is local. So, yes, we'll back people up, but we need to have people with staying power in all these towns, valleys, hamlets, and metropolises in America. That's my pitch. Pitch number two, generalizations about abortion litigation. I'm going to read, try not to drone on. There's a wonderful Talmudic scholar who died early, Yale law professor named Richard Cover. He wrote an article in the Harvard Law Review. This is to be a CLE seminar for lawyers, so you non-lawyers bear with us, but this is really as much philosophy and culture and anthropology as it is law. He writes, it's called Nomos and Narrative. What is Nomos? Greek word for meaning, a world, a field of meaning, and that's what we're about in these cases. We're trying to create, it's called jurisgenesis, another fancy word. We're creating law. And by law, I don't mean the paraphernalia of social control, edicts that say you can do this or that. Is a baby carriage in a park a vehicle covered by the no vehicle code? You know, I'm talking about meanings, life. What is human life? Isn't that a nice, humble question we address over and over again? But how do we do that in these cases? Well, here. The student of law may identify the normative world with professional paraphernalia of social control, the rules and principles of justice, the formal institutions of the law, the conventions of a social order are important to that world, but they're a small part of the normative universe that ought to claim our attention. Here's the key sentence. I pondered over this and still do. No set of legal institutions or prescriptions exists apart from the narratives that locate it and give it meaning. Here's another packed sentence. For every constitution, there is an epic. For each decalogue, Ten Commandments, a scripture. Once understood in the context of the narratives that give it meaning, law becomes not just a system of rules to be obeyed and observed, but a world in which we live. So, okay, down to cases. What do I get from that? What do I want to convey to you? Narrative. A trial is a story. And pro-life litigation, that is emphatically true. We're not just putting witnesses on to say what happened on a given day or what's the meaning of this concept. No. We're telling a story. What's the pro-life story? For example, Mrs. McCullen before the Supreme Court when she was attacked for sidewalk counseling and did it violate the law. The story is, what was she doing? She was trying to save human lives. So over and over again, we aim and frame and craft our case presentations. At least that's my approach, and I urge it ardently to all my colleagues, that we tell a story. So when we do Dalyden or when we do Scheidler, we're trying to tell a story, and it's the story of the pro-life movement. When the case got to trial, what happened in Scheidler? Well, suddenly, we were given a terrific spiritual lift. How could that be? Trial is supposed to be where you're caught in a corner, you know. The jig is up. I mean, this is the end of it now. No. The other side had a publicity apparatus from which I've learned greatly. You learn from your adversaries. We walked into the lobby of the courthouse that day when trial was to begin, picking a jury, and by gosh, I've never seen so many media representatives. CNN, Fox, they were all there. And before you know it, a microphone is put in front of you. You know, how are you going to deal with this case? Are your clients really extortionists and et cetera? And, but listen, and there was an Orthodox Jewish fellow, Yehuda Sugar. He was, my wife taught at a parochial Jewish school for a while, so they call him the Black Hats. All black, white shirt, black hat, beard in court, very Orthodox. Every day he sent out a UPI bulletin, and I got calls from long-lost relatives. What is this thing you're doing in Chicago? Well, that publicity brought attention to our cause and our efforts, and it led to support. And so suddenly we felt we had people who, as they used to say in the 60s when they were advocating against the Vietnam War, which I was involved in, you know, the whole world is watching. And so this was a case invested with great drama. And how did we deal with that then, given what I said here about narrative and so forth? Well, it was a political trial, so we decided to put the abortion issue on trial. And, you know, with all that publicity, the judge was afraid to suppress us. We put on Norma McCorvey. She'd never testified in a courtroom before. You know, Roe v. Wade was decided on paper. We put on the late Sandra Cano, who just died last year. They had to testify under their real names, not their assumed names, so the jury wouldn't know that they were Jane Roe or, I forget, Doe. What was Doe's first name? Doe versus Bolden, the companion case to Roe. So I was accused of having their biographies on my desk so the jury could see that they were Roe and Doe. And no, I wasn't trying to do that, heavens. It was all over the papers and the media and everything else. And we called Henry Hyde, the late congressman from Illinois, who authored the Hyde Amendment, and somehow I asked him the same question, which was objected to with the objection sustained three times in a row. I changed one word every time I asked it, and it was, how do you justify, because the other side pounced on this, saying that you don't support lawbreaking and Congress, and yet you support Mr. Schneider and these defendants and testify to their good character. He said, well, that's because I think that I don't want to die without knowing that I tried to suppress Auschwitz here in the United States. And the next day the headlines proclaimed, you know, Hyde compares abortion to the Holocaust, the genocidal elimination of Jews. And so in any event, we won the case, and I'm going to move on to other cases quickly because we're already down to a half hour to go. How did we win the case? I call it winning by proxy. This is my theory. Yes, we did all the legal arguing and about what extortion meant, what racketeering meant. But thanks to another pro-life infrastructure, the National Lawyers Association, an entity that's now in a little bit of trouble, but we're trying to revive it. I went to a convention in Atlanta, and I got my gumption up, and I picked the phone up and called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Many of you of my vintage will remember that was Dr. King's organization, which led the civil rights movement across the South. And, of course, what did he do? What was his tactic? There were sit-ins and lunch counters. Now, compare the theory of extortion used by the abortion industry. It was that Christians massed in front of abortion parlors singing Michael Row Your Boat Ashore for 2 hours until the police came and either dispersed them or arrested them, that was a detention of property. And therefore, extortion being defined as the obtaining of property from another by force, threat, or violence, etc., actual or threatened, that this detention of the abortionist property was an obtaining of it, a taking, because an element of property is control over your asset. Therefore, you're taking away his or her control of the asset. Well, it has a plausible sound to it, and indeed the U.S. Department of Justice had been trying to expand the extortion statute, and there were a number of precedents that said that if you cause someone to give up property by force, threat, or whatever, that's extortion. So, of course, the word obtaining means to acquire, to get. And anyway, we managed to persuade SCLC to file a friend of the court brief, And during the oral argument in December 2002, Ted Olson, the guy who won Bush versus Gore, my hearing aid is trying to fall out, was arguing against us. You know, those Republicans here, you know, who think that their party is so much behind our movement, yes, but no. They stood behind the Bush administration, Department of Justice position that they needed this broad definition. So, yes, they were for us on a side issue, but they were against us in the heart of the case. And it was Justice Ginsburg from the left wing of the court, although she sits on the far right at that point, facing the arguing counsel. Mr. Olson, is it true your theory could have been used against the civil rights movement? And he had to say, well, yes, in some cases. Well, thank you, she said, and didn't let him explain. She quoted that exchange in her concurring opinion. Rehnquist wrote the chief, the late Chief Justice wrote the opinion. 8-1, Ginsburg and Breyer joined that opinion, but she also, joined by Breyer, filed a separate concurrence and quoted that exchange. I call that trying to win by proxy. Sometimes the revulsion against what we stand for on the other side, and it seeps into the middle, is so great, especially among legal elite, because, you know, Roe versus Wade was part of the 60s revolution, continued into the 70s, the civil rights revolution that we hail as a vindication of federal adjudicative federal justice. You know, that in any event, it's good that we have friends, and they're on the left wing, and I think in retrospect, maybe they held the soggy middle together, and we came out okay. We need that same thing now with DeLeiden. I want to jump ahead. David is, of course, the 27-year-old now. He's aging rapidly. Who started this firestorm over the videos. But, you know, again, the Empire Strikes Back. We're now facing a multiple count RICO, another RICO. Here we go, deja vu all over again in San Francisco in front of a judge who makes our judge in the Scheider case look like our long-lost friend. This guy actually worked with a group that had dealings with Planned Parenthood of Golden Gate. Does that disqualify him? No, it doesn't, not under federal law. So, you know, we're going to hope he goes so far to rule against us so decisively and erroneously that it makes it that much easier on appeal. Who knows how it's going to come out, but we're fighting madly. But what did David do? He did what undercover journalists do. And so our proxy in this case is none other than the media. And indeed, the Reporters Committee for Civil Rights under law, or for journalistic freedom, I forget their exact title, but they equate their rights with civil rights, and indeed they are. It's the First Amendment. And the injunction against the release of more videos by David, and by the way, many of them have been secretly released from sources in Congress we don't know about. We had to produce them to Congress. But quite a few of them have not yet been released, and we call that what's a prior restraint on free speech, which is odious, and the reporters so argued to our judge in San Francisco, and we trust they'll argue on appeal. But we want more than just this one committee. And by the way, this is a big deal. It's not, I thought when I first saw the name, these were California reporters. No, this is from District of Columbia. These are the national media. They're endowed to the tune of $6-8 million. Andrea Mitchell, for example, is one of their directors, and they came in with a powerful brief in our favor. We hope they'll do the same up in the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, as we're now appealing that preliminary injunction. And if we don't win there, we're going to go up again. We'll be back upstairs where the air is thinner and the vision is clearer than it is sometimes down at sea level, especially around San Francisco Bay. But here is this book, Undercover Reporting, by Brooke Kroger, professor of journalism at my alma mater, after Notre Dame, my alma mater, I'm tempted to disown after the Biden, the Letari medal going to Biden and Boehner. I don't mind Boehner, but come on. But in any event, I went to law school in New York City, and she teaches journalism there. This book, Undercover Reporting, The Truth About Deception, was published by Northwestern, right down the street from where we live in Evanston, Illinois. But she recounts this marvelous tradition in American journalism. It goes back before Upton Sinclair and the Jungle and the Muckrakers. There were undercover folks who went to slave auctions and at risk of life and limb made reports about the evils of slavery seen face to face. Nellie Bly, a name familiar to me, but I couldn't say why. Well, she was an undercover reporter from the late 19th century, early 20th. She feigned mental illness and was incarcerated in a mental I shouldn't say incarcerated, although that effectively is what it was, in a mental institution, and then on and on to the modern era. But undercover journalism is in crisis. It's controversial now. How did that happen? Well, Food Lion Stores, stung, I guess, is the verb they use, by ABC, one of their undercover programs, and Food Lion sued. And Food Lion, and this is about 15, 20 years ago, Food Lion got a six-figure judgment of punitive damages in the lower court. They were ABC undercover reporters that went in as employees and took pictures and so forth of unsanitary practices. And it was reversed on appeal to just a few dollars because you cannot get what they call publication damages. The real hurt or harm is how your reputation was affected, and that should have been a libel case. And under the law of libel, the First Amendment applies and insists that you show malicious intent. You either knew or should have known or had reckless disregard for knowing that something you published was untrue. Well, what they published was true. And indeed, the same is true of Brother Dalyden, isn't it? I mean, you know, they say it's a cascade of pejoratives. The heavily edited tapes, distorted tapes, the deceptions, our judge said that his activity was lacking in integrity. Oh, come on, judge. I mean, that's outrageous. He published not only the highlights, which is what any editor would do. How about ABC or CBS? You don't publish the entirety of a recording. He published the highlights, yes, but at the same time, he published the unedited transcript, the entire video. Well, now, wait a minute. See, he didn't publish everything on the video. What did he leave out? Well, he left out the bathroom breaks. For heaven's sakes, these people put these undercover devices on in the morning, and they didn't take them off. You don't shut them off. They were on the entire day. When we were subpoenaed by Congress, we produced even the bathroom breaks. We wanted, at cost of embarrassment to some of these folks who were investigators, we felt that the record should show, at least in the Congress, notwithstanding the criticisms, unfounded as they were, that there was nothing to hide here at all. And indeed, the expert report, not Planned Parenthood's, but our independently produced report, verified that. And that'll be pointed out on the appeal, among so many other things. So, what happened to undercover journalism? Well, the Food Lion case caused a shock and an uproar, and there was an undercover piece in Chicago. They published in our good racket-ridden city of Chicago called The Mirage. The Mirage was a fake bar set up by the Chicago Sun-Times, and they had photographers up in the behind a false ceiling and recording devices galore. And as each and every one of Chicago's finest came in to sell this permit or that permit or this license or that license, all was recorded in graphic detail and technicolor and then printed in the paper. And guess what? Because of Food Lion, the Mirage, the all-time favorite to get the Pulitzer Prize was denied the Pulitzer Prize. The elite of the media, national media, led by Ben Bradley, the late publisher or the late editor of the Washington Post, famous for Watergate, said, "Nope, journalists are dedicated to truth, and therefore you cannot engage in deception." But that was an aberration, at least according to Brooke Kroger in her history and articles she's written. There have been umpteen stings, undercover stings, since then. And as she points out, with a logic I don't think could be disputed, what is also at stake is the hidden truth, truth that will never come to light if measures aren't taken to find a way to penetrate the veil of secrecy that hangs about some of these victims of stings that show the truth. Yes, there are moral issues here, and I'm not a moralist or a theologian. My job is to defend DeLayden, and I'm going to defend him to my utmost. And here's the kind of truth. Well, thank you very much. But, you know, here, before he did it, and I know, I'm sorry, I'm skipping all kinds of cases. The embryo cases, yes, we filed against Sofia Vergara. we file with scientific evidence that life begins at conception. I think the courts should hear that when they are told that they should treat embryos as property. This is Dred Scott in the 21st century. Is it a human being or is it a chattel? It's not a chattel. It's a human being. And the standard should be the best interest of the child, not what the parents decide they want to do with their, quote, property, unquote. So we've submitted to these courts half a foot of scientific evidence. It's a biological truth. Maybe they're not legal persons in the eyes of the law, but they sure are human. If they're not, what species do they belong to? And they're alive, although frozen, they're beings. And so that's I say that in honor of the agenda that we don't have time to address. But before David started out, of course, he talked to our good friend from Denton, Texas, who spoke earlier today, who had done an investigation of baby parts selling earlier. He also talked to a famous, and in her immodest affidavit, she describes herself as a preeminent scientist in the field of adult stem cell therapies and regenerative medicine, 23 patents to my name, which have generated $200 million in fees, et cetera, et cetera. And her name is Teresa Deischer, educated at Stanford. I informed David DeLayden and the Center for Medical Progress that according to what the journals tell about stem cell research, that in order to harvest, optimally harvest fetal tissue within 5 minutes of death, the organ needs to be removed, flushed of all blood, cleansed of any extraneous tissue, placed into a liquid with enzymes which digest the connective tissue and releases the cells. That suggests to you, and she goes on to say, I informed David and CMP that it was not only reasonable to suppose, but practically certain, repeat that, practically certain, that the method of inducing abortion is altered in order to facilitate the harvesting of fetal organs along this expedited schedule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she talks about Holly O'Donnell's video. I don't know if you folks have seen the Holly O'Donnell video. Holly is also somebody we're representing. Maybe she'll have separate counsel down the road. She's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Here's what she said on video, and Ms. Deischer comments on it. how she was instructed to harvest neural, N-E-U-R-A-L, fetal tissue from a fetus with a beating heart. So I hear my STEM Express trainer calling. STEM Express is a TPO, tissue procurement outfit. Hey, Holly, come over here. I wanted you to see something kind of cool. It's kind of neat. So I'm over here, and there's this moment. I see it. I'm flabbergasted. It's the most gestated fetus and closest thing to a baby I've ever seen. And she's like, okay, I want to show you something. So she has one of her instruments, and she just taps the heart, and it starts beating. And I'm sitting there here, and I'm looking at this fetus, and its heart is beating, and I don't know what to think. And she's like, do you know why that's happening? And I knew why it was happening. It was because the electrical current, the nodes, were still firing. She's a trained phlebotomist, not a physician. And I don't know if that constitutes that it's technically dead or it's alive. It had a face. It wasn't completely torn up, and its nose was very pronounced. It had eyelids. Its mouth was pronounced. And then, since the fetus was so intact, she said, okay, well, this is a very good fetus, and it looks like we can procure a lot from it. We're going to procure brain. So the moment I heard that, I was like, that means we're going to have to cut the head open. We're going to have to cut the head open. So, okay, what you do is you go through the face, she said. I was thinking, no, I don't want to do this. Well, she quit, but the truth came out of there with her. And indeed, a lot of this is videoed, and Planned Parenthood will deny it. They'll say it's distorted. But I think let the chips fall where they may. I think the American people will have to judge, and they'll make a judgment, no matter what the court decides. We have 9 minutes left, I guess, before we're to break for some questions. There are some other cases we have, and by the way, I think we have some good defenses to these RICO charges, and as I said before, we're going to give it our utmost, but, you know, we're in California. It's not Ohio, not even Illinois. So, and I tell the young lawyers, I say, well, if you're going to do this kind of work, let me tell you this one thing for sure. You've got to learn how to take some punches in the early rounds. And you hang around till the end. And, you know, in the Scheidler case, my God, it ended, do you believe, a year and a half ago, 28 years. Why the delay? We won 8-1 in 2003. They went back to the lower court, the people that ruled against us, the on appeal. One of the panel members being an Obama finalist for the Supreme Court. And we stopped her 5 years ago, and I hope we'll stop her again. They ruled that the Supreme Court had overlooked some things in the record and therefore sent it down to the trial judge, our old friend from the NAACP, so he can decide if what they overlooked is enough to keep the judgment against the defendants intact, despite the Supreme Court ruling 8-1. Come on. Only in abortion cases. And it was done on a gambit, a pretty good gambit, that they would never take the same case three times. They lost the gambit. They took it a third time. The Supreme Court did not admonish them, did not smack them down for disobeying the mandate, but they went to this other theory that supposedly was overlooked, and they addressed it, and they ruled it would have been 9, but O'Connor had retired, and Alito had not heard the argument, so it was 8-0. But then they fought us tooth and nail over our costs. The only records we had amounted to $65,000 in costs for all those years. And, you know, the Scheiders, they had some good records from the trial. We had witnesses flying in from around the country, hotel bills, meal bill, you know, and but they fought us tooth and nail. They said those costs were exorbitant. Well, we had to fight that. It took 8 years. Why? Our judge didn't rule on it. And he sat and waited. And then he retired from the bench without telling us. We checked, and my gosh, he'd gone. He was absent from the bench, and it had the case was in limbo, so we had to ask the next judge. He ruled for us. He gave us, I think, $62,000 or something. They appealed. I'm happy to say that the appellate court smacked them down, and they called their arguments, quote unquote, preposterous. So, you know, it took a long time, but justice will out, and I hope and pray that we can accomplish the same result for Dalyden. But I think the way to do it is to put them on trial, and that'll take, defending a case half a continent away is a challenge. We've had a lot of support, for which I'm extremely grateful, but we've got to sustain that probably for years more than I'll be practicing law or walking on the earth, maybe. Who knows, given the length of the other one, because these are epic battles. You know, as my Jewish scholar friend I quoted earlier said, these are, the word epic applies to these cultural battles, because things are at issue, like what is a human being, what is our identity, and so forth. So they're Dred Scott-type issues in these cases, and I think we've got to beat the drum as loud as we can about the hidden truth, the need to uncover it. I think we need the media. Some of them will come to our aid, many of them will not, and they'll find differences. For example, the 60 Minutes. Did you see 3 weeks ago the foreign corrupt official supposedly visiting leaders of the corporate bar in New York, asking if they would help to, not using the word, but cleanse corrupt, ill-gotten gains from abroad by this corrupt official so he could use his money, his dirty money, to buy real estate and yachts in the U.S. Only one of the 15 said, this is not my cup of tea. You guys, thank you, but there's the door. Another one was the sitting president of the American Bar Association. He entertained them for half an hour or 40 minutes. He did say something about, we'll have to look into the legality of this, but he was very anxious to be giving them advice during the other minutes it took, other than telling them that he had to look into the legality of it. And were they different from Dalyden? Well, somebody said, well, your guy used false IDs. State issued. Well, have you ever tried to get into a high-rise office building in downtown Cleveland? When we go to the high-rise office building where our opposing counsel is in San Francisco, we have to pull out our government-issued IDs and tell them exactly who we are and why we're coming there and whom we're visiting. And I don't think that they declared that they were from CBS News doing undercover research. So, you know, we'll be making some law. It's jurisgenesis here. To what extent is this mail or wire fraud another predicate act under RICO, or is it they've added predicate acts under RICO to go after terrorists? So we've got something about identification fraud and this kind of thing that we've got to cope with. We're working again with RICO experts. Bob Lakey, the Notre Dame professor, retired now, who wrote RICO. He named the statute Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, about as cumbersome a title as you can, but he wanted to come out as RICO because he's a film buff, and you may remember Little Caesar. Little Caesar was the movie about Al Capone, but his name in the movie was RICO, and the final scene is Edward G. Robinson sinking to the floor, having been shot by the FBI or something, say, Mother of Mercy, is this the end of RICO? So that's why we get this cumbersome name RICO for the federal statute. But what else can I tell you about? I got 3 minutes and 32 seconds left, and maybe, you know, the Religious Freedom Act, they say Hobby Lobby is a corporation. Corporations don't go to church. We didn't represent Hobby Lobby. Other people did, and did it very ably. We represented a Grand Rapids, Michigan firm, AutoCam, and on the heels of Hobby Lobby, AutoCam was a little different because it was not a wholly owned private company. It was majority owned. So the control was in private hands, and The Hobby Lobby president applied there too. So, but the people who run the corporations are people like you and me. They're flesh and blood. A corporation is simply an artificial entity recognized at law, but it's actually, in reality, a collection of individuals, as are General Motors. And so why shouldn't their religious rights be protected? And now, of course, the Little Sisters of the Poor, they're not, well, they are a corporation, aren't they? They're a religious corporation. But now, with the death of Justice Scalia, the left-wing, right-wing split is 4-4. And some people think that that'll cause an impasse, and the Little Sisters will indeed, as they said they would, have to leave the United States, go back to France, because of the mandate that they purchase abortifacient and other forms of contraception, which they say violates their religious faith. The government says, no, no, it's not that big a deal. You're not supposed to care so much about these little things like this. But shouldn't it be the right of the believer to, it's always been the law, in my understanding, to profess what he or she believes in and what he or she does not believe in. And not the government's prerogative to say, or a court's prerogative to say, well, that belief doesn't, it's not substantial, therefore there's no real burden on you. Well, I think that the case will be reargued, which is often done, and I'm joined by other experts. I'm not an expert on it, but who think that it'll be reargued, so there should be an outcome. I hope whenever the next, whoever he or she will be, person on that Supreme Court is nominated. But, you know, we may lose this battle. It may be Hillary Clinton that's the next president. Who knows? We don't know. And we may be entering a period of persecution here that we've not yet conceived of. And if that's the case, it's another punch to take. And I think our movement, no matter what happens, will become all the stronger. You know, we had bad days in the Schuyler case where really we had no concept how we'd endure, much less prevail. We had this faith, but it was a fighting faith, and that's what animated us, and I think that's what animates our whole movement. You know, when we sidewalk counsel, we see men and women go into those clinics. And, you know, more often than not, it ends in abortion, not a save. And yet we don't get discouraged. We're down about it. We grieve. We mourn. But we come back with renewed strength and determination. And I have every reason to believe it may not be in my lifetime or in all of yours, but it'll be an ultimate victory. I hope and pray, and we'll continue to work to that end. I'm down to zero, so we did it just right. I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about Phil Klein, prosecuted Planned Parenthood, and now thereafter they've taken away his law license. We have, I think, a good argument. A wonderful Ohio lawyer, my kind of lawyer, Tom Condit, down in Cincinnati, is fighting for Phil with our support, but I'm very happy, Tom. He's got a great argument. The Kansas Constitution says the Kansas Supreme Court shall decide who practices law and under what ethical rules. And five of the seven justices on that court recused themselves from Phil's case, leaving only two members of the court. That's less than a quorum. And one of the two picked lower court judges to take the place of the five who recused. Well, was that seven-person court, if that's what you call it, the Supreme Court of Kansas? I think that's a pretty darn good question. And we filed a civil rights case in Kansas. They brought in a judge from Oklahoma to sit on the case, and the two sides have filed briefs, and let's pray that there is an ounce of justice. I think they ought to void that opinion. And the recommendation that he be suspended from the practice of law is only a recommendation. Only the Kansas Supreme Court can decree discipline. I still haven't covered the whole ground, but listen, thank you for listening to me, and I guess if there are any questions, we've got... Or do we? Maybe not, Gordon.
We're going to share. You can stay right there unless you need to take a seat. All right, let's thank Tom Brecker. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, we actually have about 2 minutes here, so we got one question we can get to. One quick legal question. We'll just do the one. Aren't there laws for against Planned Parenthood, against selling baby parts? Isn't that abuse of a corpse? Or are there any other laws?
Thanks, Gordon. Absolutely. There are four laws at issue. Can't change the procedure unless consented to, and they change it right and left. That's on the tapes that are online. You can't sell the parts. You can only gift them. Again, this is... We call it non-commodification of... There are certain things that shouldn't be traded. I didn't get into this. That's how we won the Schreider case. Some things are... Some markets are illegal. Some are partly illegal, like the market for guns. It's regulated. The market for cigarettes, it's very regulated. Some markets are completely banned. The market for heroin, banned. That market cannot exist. It's a black market if it exists at all. And there's another law that escapes me now because I'm having a senior moment. But I'll think of it later.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to Tom Brecker, President and Chief Counsel for the Thomas More Society, defending the sanctity of life, religious liberty, and family values, and a Bringing America Back to Life Convention 2016 speaker.